Run through some parts in terms of your evidence. So on page 8, in terms of the general amendments and comments, I just wanted to understand, in terms of 16.7.2 with the minor amendments, are there submissions that allow us to make those minor amendments, or are they just improvements that you're recommending?
Plan improvement.
Helps when you turn it on. So I'm just trying to understand whether the improvements, the very good clarification and that kind of thing, but are we able to do that in terms of our deliberations and our recommendations?
I believe so. They don't change the chapter. And it's in the comments down the right-hand side of the redrafted chapter, noted where it changes the role of submission and where it's not there for clarity.
Ms. Scott, can I ask you from a legal perspective, whether the minor amendments from that, we're able to do those?
Yes, so those changes are not specific to any submission points, but they are, in the council's view, not of any substance, not of any change in regulatory effect. They're simply there to, for the purposes of better structure or better. So that, in essence, the plan is easier to read, and similar changes have been recommended through other hearings, and care has been taken to assure that where there's any change that was in substance or change of regulatory effect of a rule or a standard or objective of policy, then that has been noted.
Okay.
So the answer in the council's position is yes.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. Turning to page 14, 8.21, just as it particularly in regard to the airport, I just want to be the aircraft being controlled and aircraft noise through the designation, the underlying zoning where the designation applies for all of that. Is the Queenstown mixed use zone, is that correct?
I believe that's correct.
But in terms of the rules and that we're looking at here, it's not about aircraft noise. The rules regarding the noise are in regard to any activities that occur within that zone.
Is that correct? Yeah.
To read. To non-aviation activities.
Okay. 8.29, and this is to do with this village activity area. So what I'm trying to understand now is that at the very end of that paragraph, is that effectively all sorted now? There's no disagreement between Dr. Charles, yourself, and the submission in regards to the change?
I don't believe so, other than that
include
the
CIC
activity area, but
so it's not sorted.
Well, I've sort of got this in the summary. Paragraph 6.
So that's just in regard to the non-compliant as the activity takes for it.
Yeah.
While we're on that, I recall reading in Mr. Ferguson's evidence something about he didn't consider that there was anything in the objectives and policies that directed in terms of the formulation of the rule for it to be a non-compliant activity status. What's your view on that linkage?
Policy 36.2.1. 36.2.1.2 policy. About avoiding, remedying, or mitigating adverse noise, adverse disability effects. And similarly, the policy above it also talks about avoiding, remedying, or mitigating adverse effects. We're on page 36.1 of the
avoid, remedy or mitigate, since that provides a large number of options there. Just looking at the policy, I've been distracted by subdivision. What's the noise related part of subdivision that we're looking at there?
That's a good point. Not generally subdivision and noise effects resulting from subdivision, it would be the land use that came with it.
Preparation works for the subdivision.
The construction
of the subdivision.
Do you think that would be covered by development activities?
Construction rules somewhere.
There is a noise rule for construction.
Also, just in nice and short, we'll get to some policies. I go on about this to everybody, so it's just so that you don't feel left out. When the objective talks about that at the end between land is managed, but managed to what effect? Talking about policies down below, I'm assuming that there are no submissions on the policies?
There was a submission in support of objects and policies, and there was actually a submission on policy 36.2.1.2. Actually, it's covered in the report. refresh myself as to point. That's right, it was regarding the existing uses. That's paragraph 8.14.
Turning over to page 18, 8.36. This is just of the margins of lakes and rivers. Are there any history of complaints regarding that matter?
I'm not aware of any, but someone from the council probably clarified that for you, further information if there were, but none that I was made aware of when hearing this.
In the, but through the other chapters, there's been monitoring reports undertaken on particular activities on 765. Are there any of those sort of reports that were unprepared ahead of preparing this chapter?
Not that aware of.
Regarding Mr. Dean's evidence, have you read the environment court decision that noise limit apparently comes from, derived from?
I've read the particular section that relates to that, isolated issue.
You're aware that the court was concerned that it should be for a limited period? Do you consider there are planning reasons why it would be appropriate to be in the plan and therefore not have that limitation?
No, my preference would be not to provide for something that's specifically provided for under the resource consent and the district plan. If you were taking that approach, you could have the plan littered with rules related to particular activities that are consented. And I think given the time limit on the consent, if you were to include it in the proposed plan, as you launched at the start of the hearing today, then there for the life of the proposed plan, whereas the consent is only for 4 or 5 years.
I was just trying to elicit your opinion, because really you hadn't expressed it in that paragraph. I've got a series of questions on the chapter, chapter 36 in your version. I'll start with before I turn to your evidence. but I understand you didn't write chapter 36, so some of these questions will be just trying to clarify what was intended, and they may have been given us originally.
Sure.
In section 3.6, in the second to last paragraph, at the very end of the paragraph, it says noise from overflying aircraft is controlled under section 29A of the Civil Aviation Act. Can you check that section?
That's the section, but I haven't
read it in the
Act.
You'd accept that it's section 29B?
I would have to check that.
Yeah, that's I think it's probably a typographical
error. Okay.
But,
that's something we can
address in the slide. Now, with the objective there, it appeared to me that it's sort of repeating itself, with commencing with the adverse effects of noise emissions and then going on arising from the adverse noise effects. And I'm wondering whether some further non-substantive amendments to turn it into an objective with an outcome could be possible by deleting the first, the adverse effects and commencing with the noise emissions, and that the what I've been trying to achieve is to avoid or that the potential for conflict between land use activities arising from noise effects is managed or avoided or something.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that managing something is an outcome. That's, mm-hmm. that's my fundamental concern with the and the problem is there inherently in the objective that, to start with. But I suppose the question is, what is it the council is trying to achieve here? Is it trying to avoid conflict between land use activities because of noise effects? Is that the fundamental essence of what the sort?
Yes, it is.
I'm happy to leave you to think about how that might be expressed in the reply, but I think that the way it's written really doesn't provide any guidance to a decision maker on an application for breach of noise, you know, given that all it says is, well, we're going to manage the effects.
So that could have left reasonable
Where section 16 provides an obligation to avoid unreasonable noise, so I think technically council's objective shouldn't be any less than section 16.
Mm-hmm.
Right,
yeah, that was.
And it follows that you want to change the next policy probably as well. The policy 36211.
And the conclusion was reached that the case scope, it's probably worth highlighting that for us because we may want to consider whether that still requires improvement. And look, 1.2, I'm just wondering whether the intention there is to avoid remedy or mitigate adverse noise reverse sensitivity effects in all circumstances.
Okay.
a number of utility and network utility operators who come to us and say that there's been a reverse sensitivity effect that you need to do X. Is that the council's intention, or is it that there should be some overall management approach to how those reverse sensitivity effects are dealt with? I mean, if it was in all circumstances, it would suggest that we don't need noise limits on the airport, because... As an example. Turning now to table one, and 36.47. And you've seen this in your summary as well, and I know it's in, I think it's in Aurora's submissions. They use the term sound from emergency and backup electrical generators. What's your understanding of the difference between the two? And the rule itself provides for maintenance and testing of the emergency and backup generators, but that doesn't suggest that backups are only in cases where maintenance may be occurring.
Okay.
The other question that I'll raise at the Aurora, it's my understanding that they have what they might be referring to and might pay to check with Ms. Dowd on this. They have generators at the end of their very long lines to deal with voltage drop. And I think in part that may be their intention, voltage drop generators. I know there's one in the Cadrona Valley. In which case they should be, that should be clearly defined as to what we're talking about. I'd hate to see a whole series of backup generators being put through urban areas on the basis that they're a committed activity.
So it's whether a backup generator might be something where should the spot price of power get too high that they don't take it off the grid anymore, start the backup generator up, and it's cheaper to burn diesel than it is to pay the spot price.
So there will be circumstances. Now, rule 56.52. Would it be clearer if it said sound from non-aviation activities rather than land place activities? I think that's the intention, isn't it, of this rule?
That is the intention. I know that people just like to be clear on what aviation activity is defined as, and whether that would include maintenance. Because I know that the zone provides some maintenance. I think that would be...
I don't think that rule would allow for engine testing.
No, not
which is the sort of maintenance you'd be talking about. The other question I have is a more fundamental one. Why can they be noisier than everyone else in the district?
I believe that.
But double the noise.
Yeah. soil came in through plan change.
Did it come in?
Did PC 45 increase the noise? Is it PC 35?
35.
Or is it coming from other plan change? Because it seems surprising that one discrete zone can have a noisier effect than everywhere else. It might be just worth checking back that that was actually, that the intention has been, of what was in the operative plan has been carried forward. The operative plan may not be written quite that way. But the operative plan is very confusing, so I wouldn't surprise you if it's true. I know the heading says commercial motorised craft, but the rule itself doesn't. Is that the intention, that it only applies to commercial operators who require consents to operate?
It is. I think there wasn't scope.
Which applies to all craft. Right. Which removes
the testing requirements.
So is it intended to apply to all craft?
As a draft, it's intended only to apply to commercial craft. As it is drafted, commercial motorised craft.
Well, from your professional point of view, is it appropriate for it to apply to all craft, or should it just be commercial?
I think it would be helpful if it applied to all motorised craft.
How practical is that for the council to administer?
Practical,
I guess,
I'm thinking of an isolated instance where there might be a non-commercial motorised craft.
There have been, I can hear them from my house going up and down the Clutha River, but the jet boats move so quickly that the chances of an enforcement officer getting down there and measuring it and seeing they don't comply pretty slim. I'm just wondering how practical. But the officer that I was just by Jasky. Yeah, but he's in Waikato.
not the whole of town.
Yeah, true. I mean, I agree that there are some submitters who are saying that the noise from all craft from the lakes are problems, and I accept that there is an issue, but I'm wondering about the practicality of, it's a bit like controlling the noise of vehicles on roads, isn't it?
Yeah, I
accept
that.
So, vehicles on roads, the noise is controlled by the police, as I understand it.
Mm.
Whereas, how do you deal with it on a lake?
I think section 16 does not apply to noise coming from the lake.
I think that would be the officer that I would most definitely imagine. They would have a lot of effective input to there was a table competition that was applying for the same.
I think for Scott it would be useful to, for the council, not put all this on Ms. Evans, she's a consultant for the council, but for the council to consider from their own view that they want to be in the position of monitoring all craft on the lakes for noise. And the rivers, whether it's commercial craft that they want to deal with.
Yes, we can cover that in the reply. I think the rule as notified was focused on commercial craft, and my understanding is that the operative rule wasn't particular to commercial craft, so there's been a change there through the notification.
And I have seen some submissions that seek that have applied to all craft, so. Mm. It is open, but I think it needs to be dealt with from the councils.
Well, the practicality of measuring and enforcing such standards are very real, I think. I acknowledge what you have raised in terms of how that would happen and how the council would do that in our decision.
Well, and on the wider lake, of course, there's a matter of pinpointing which craft it is.
Yes, and I've grown up in with boats, so, and not jet skiing myself, but they disappear fairly quickly, so it would be a race to catch them, I suspect.
if it was just motorised, commercial motorised craft, then the underlying part at the bottom of that rule would possibly just have the word commercial on the system.
Yeah. That's another question for you, Mr. Scott. It's been the suggestion that we can't deal with the real duty submission on the water feet. For all visitors, and yet there are suggestions here that we should have controls on the rural visitor zone adjoining the Waikato Airport, which is not part of the stage either. And I'm wondering how we should handle that. Seems inconsistent to deal with one and not the other. On front page 14 of the rules. It's not the specific as to which one it is, but.
Yes, my understanding there is the Walter Peak is a specific spot to a submitter requesting that it be included in the Planning and Fire Commission, whereas it's already included that notification.
Right.
So slightly different facts there, and that is why the different recommendation was made for Walter Peak. The council's not saying there's no merit in that specific submission on Walter Peak, but is saying it's best considered in stage two next to the purpose of that zone. Whereas this one on page 14, that was notified within the chapter, I can't explain why, that is what it is.
And if the council was to decide to zone that something else, then they would vary this as a response in the stage two?
Yes, and I guess to answer that question would be preempting what the council's going to do. So apologies, I can't really assist you anymore.
But I think as a process, that would be the way to do it.
As a process, yes.
Okay. On the same page this evening, which is 36.14, and it's a couple of places that refers to the air noise boundary and the out of control boundaries. Would it, from your point of view, be helpful if it specified that those were the boundaries as shown on the planning maps?
To respond to your question earlier about the location of those boundaries on the planning map.
Yes.
The submission of the airport that's been lodged in this stage.
Yes, they seek the change 35 feet imposed.
Yes, so what they do is they acknowledge that the discrepancy relates to the location of lot 6, and the airport submission specifically says that we would like to see this other location of the boundaries in the proposed plan, and they specifically ask for different boundary locations to come in. So it's their submission that's created the scope for the change, which is, I understand to be the question that you asked earlier this morning. So there is scope there to change the location of them. And
does their submission go beyond what sense? Does it include the entire? Because the one that's shown on the plan is shown as being operative. But I'm not sure it is the operative version. I think it's the change 35 pattern.
Yes, and I think we have discussed this in an earlier hearing. In particular, when the hearing was resumed to hear from the airport and the council after conferencing that happened in the strategic directions hearing, and I understand an explanation was given by the airport and Mr. Winchell and the council, and that the location of the boundaries was provided by the airport prior to notification, and then subsequently lodged this submission seeking that it be updated given the ongoing litigation in the Environment Court related to Lot 6. This part of the submission that I'm looking at is focused on the Lot 6 component, not the wider boundaries. And
perhaps it's something that we can clarify at the mapping hearings, but what I'm trying to get my head around is whether ignoring the part within the Remarkables Park zone, because that's the end that affected by the the real question is that the rest of the line is actually the line as the court has determined on change 35. And if it is, notwithstanding what it says in the legend, that might be the right place. And for the legend at the front, as Queenstown air noise boundary and out of control boundary has been operative. Change 35 isn't operative, so they...
No, it's not, so we have a decision.
So that's where it's confusing.
Yes. And
that's what I'd like to... Someone would tell us how we can be fixed. I understand the Lot 6 issue, and that requires the company to make a decision on that. I understand that might happen this year.
Well, we have two processes, and the Environment Court's decision on Plan Change 35 will of course go into the operative plan. We then have what we have this review process, and the panel's recommendations are of course guided and limited by the scope of submission. I understand what you're asking is whether the legend is actually an error in the legend, and whether the boundaries which are shown on the notified planning map are simply a rollover from the operative plan and are labelled as the operative boundaries, or whether they are the something else.
Yes. Or are they the change 35 ones without the allowance for lot 6, which was the other option. And then the reason it gets important, because there seems to be zonings based on that boundary in some parts, and there's a whole series of effects in the residential rules in addition to the noise requirements dependent on where those lines are.
Yes.
Being one side of the line or the other can make a big difference to any landowner.
Yes. Well, we will look back at the airport's evidence, because I quote that the answer's buried in there somewhere, or in one of the sets of submissions that have been filed. So we will look into that. Otherwise, I'm sure the legal counsel will have the answer in definitive. And there was also a question as to the status of plan change 35 and the weight that can be given to it. The environmental court has of course issued this decision, but the council has not at this time formally approved it, and it doesn't yet form part of the operative plan. Section 86E of course applies, and it has legal effect in terms of consenting, but in this forum where we are in terms of planning and policy, it's the council's submission that even though that final procedural stamping process hasn't happened, the amount of weight that can be given to the environment court's decision is covered in the legal submission that we've been given, and it's of course not binding on the council and the panel at this point in time, but it is reasonably recent. And in terms of the legal submissions that have been filed, we do set out possible exceptions where there might be movement from the position that the Environment Court has concerned, such as a change in facts or circumstances, or a significant change in technology or the like. And the council just refers to and adopts those submissions and doesn't consider that it hasn't yet been formally adopted by a council, doesn't change that.
So, that being the case, then clarification of what the line on the map actually represents would be helpful. If it represents the air noise boundaries and out of control boundaries as they would be without the inclusion of lot 6, as determined by the Environment Court, then we would give them appropriate weight. But if they are the pre-plan change 35 ones, then clearly they are. And that's where we need to know which one they are.
Yes,
we can't tell from the Environment Court decision if it doesn't attach a plan showing whether
we'll get that answer for you soon.
Sorry,
back to you, Ms.
In the definitions, in the definition of noise, I'm just wondering whether the last paragraph, which talks about how to assess noise from helicopters, excuse me, is that a definition or a standard? Or is it advice about?
Clarification.
I think that would be helpful, I think, for the vice note for it to state that. And in the, I just wanted to ask you about your suggestion change the national boundary where you see the east side. I mean, my experience dealing with noise walls around the country is generally the facade, 20 metres from the facade. Would it be equally give effect to the submitter's point that the any facade? Make it clear that it's not just the front of the house.
Yes, I'll have to look up that question again, but I think the point was that
may have meaning of the front.
That's right.
I think that might be an easier and clearer way, because I think all the noise experts understand where the national boundary is from. I think it's actually in the noise thing that is facade. I have one or two questions on your section 42A report. Commissioner Sinclair did not ask. Then page 18, paragraph 8.37, you refer to rule 36.54. Status was actually irrelevant because the way the rule was written, it's impossible to breach it. So a dash is probably more appropriate. There is no non-compliance.
Yes, I checked with a dash.
On page 20, paragraph 843, you deal with informal airports and you refer to the rural zone provisions. Just wondering, given that the informal airport rules in the rural zone provide a level of use which is considered to comply with the noise standards in Chapter 36, whether the rules in Chapter 36 shouldn't include some reference to that deemed compliance.
Would that be regarding the number of sites in the...
Yes, well, I mean, the rule chapter says that if you're in a certain location and you don't have more than a certain number of flights each day, then you're permitted. But the noise rules don't have any reference to that, and it says that the noise rules overrule the zone rules, which seems to me a potential or future litigation having heard from submitted on both sides of this argument. It would be nice if the noise rules clarified the deep effect of compliance of the rule. So noise. You might like to think about how that happens. So, just the other question that we will read up.
May I make a correction to my appendix that I didn't note at the start? So the appendix 2 of C42A, which is the 60x table, on page 9, in relation to point, submission point 383.72, down the bottom of the table, second row from the bottom. In the deferred column, it states deferred to hearing stream business. That should be struck out.
Sorry?
The zero, it should be deleted. That's from column 2.
And we can deal with that at this hearing in the spring.
Energy and utilities are important to the well-being of the district. However, their effects on the environment need to be managed. To the extent practicable, all the rules for these have been located in the Energy and Utilities chapter. I have recommended a number of changes to the Energy and Utilities chapter and identified areas where modifications could improve the direction of the chapter. In particular, I consider that the effects and policies related to energy could be improved. However, I do not believe there is scope to make these improvements. Electricity transmission. Having reviewed the evidence filed by TransPower, Aurora and PowerNet, I accept that further modifications could be made, in particular to the rules relating to the definition of minor upgrades to provide greater certainty. I agree with the request of TransPower that Rule 3410 should include activities as well as buildings and structures within the National Grid Yard. I wish to hear the presentation of the following submissions before I confirm my agreement to them. These include the request of Aurora to provide direct protection for the 11 kV distribution line from Wanaka to Mick Aurora, the request of Aurora to increase the setback for the corridor at redraft rule 31.510 to 32 metres, along with a restricted discretionary activity status, rather than the current recommendation of 10 metres and non-compliant status. The request by Transpower for a fence or a 45 metre setback of activities from the Franklin substation and the evidence of RORA and Power Act which proposes controlled activity status for placement of new lines. Lines on roads. The issue raised by Aurora and PowerNet in relation to the activity status for the placement of new lines should have arisen because the operative district plan provides for lines within legal roads as a permitted activity, but the proposed district plan provides either a controlled or discretionary activity status. Under the ODP, the rules pertaining to lines refer to activities and zones. The default rule for activities not otherwise specified is permitted, as all legal roads are not zoned in the ODP. Lines are permitted and open centres required. The PDP rules regulate activities on a district-wide basis and generally do not specify that activities need to be located within a zone. In this chapter, in the PDP, the default rule for activities not specified is discretionary. Accordingly, new sub-transmission lines on roads is a controlled activity. I consider that the location of lines, whether underground or overground within formed level roads, to generally be appropriate and acknowledge that this is an established practice in the district. Accordingly, while I have not yet taken a view as to the appropriate default activity status for utilities, building structures and earthworks generally, in my view, a permitted activity status for new lines on roads would be appropriate. However, I have not yet formed a view as the most appropriate manner to provide this. This matter was not raised by Aurora or PowerNet on these submissions. However, PowerNet did seek the default activity status for lines to be permitted. Accordingly, I consider that there is scope within the submission of PowerNet to provide for a permitted activity status for lines on roads. Telecommunication. I consider the evidence presented by Mr. McDonald Clark on behalf of Vodafone's passing core is helpful, and I agree that additional modifications can be made to the provisions related to telecommunications to provide both clarity and further enablement. In particular, I generally agree with Mr. McDonald Clark's suggested modifications to Rule 34.14 pertaining to telecommunication and radio masks, and the modifications to redraft Rule 34.19 to simplify and increase the area of the NTA. However, I am wary of supporting components of the draft National Environmental Standards for Telecommunications Facilities, as the Council must observe the NESDF as it is at the time a decision is made on the PDP. I also consider that it is not onerous for masks to be finished in recessive colour in all rural locations, not just the ONS and ONL. Other submissions. Queenstown Park has requested that the provisions on public transport and the energy utilities chapter include references to gondolas. I maintain that as there is no provision for a gondola structure in any part of the PDP, it is not appropriate for gondolas to be considered utilities. QPL has requested provision for a gondola for a rezoning submission that has not yet been heard. If the submission is recommended to be accepted, then the panel will have the opportunity to consider whether provision for the gondola as utility is also appropriate at that stage. I also note that QPL has not submitted any planning or evidence on the energy utilities chapter to support this decision. I generally agree with the intent of the submission of the New Zealand Transport Agency. However, I am reluctant to include specific transport-related components into the definition of utility, because this means that any person creating such a structure could deem themselves a utility provider. I consider that the NZCA have addressed their own issues. That the definition of utility includes them by virtue of including anything described as a network utility operator under Section 166 of the RMA. And I maintain my position set out in the strategic and rural hearings that I do not support the qualifier where practical within a policy framework because this weakens the maintenance and protection of environmental values where they are necessary to be maintained and protected. Drafting issues. Some helpful suggestions have been made in evidence by submitters to improve the drafting and clarity of the energy utilities chapter. This includes the evidence that Mr. McCullum Clark has with the definition of building as notified as applicable to utilities and on the relationship between the energy utilities chapter and other chapters. However, I wish to hear the presentation of the relevant submissions before I recommend that these be accepted. For example, I consider that Rule 30.3.3.2 provides certainty of the overall activity status of the land use. I agree that Rules 30.3.1 and 30.3.3 appear to be in conflict with the energy utilities rules prevail over other provisions. the implication of these measures by Mr. McDowell Clark will form any additional recommendation in the Council's reply. Thank you. Apologies for the link.
Start with a summary first, just in paragraph 3, including activities as well as buildings within the National Grid Yard. The National Grid Yard, as I recall from earlier hearings here, really only applies to the line from Queenstown that goes through to Cromwell.
Yes, that's right. It was that's the district.
That's the only one, correct? Just in terms of that, if it's the activities under it, in terms of that rule, I assume that's any sort of rural activity, like, I don't know, ploughing it?
Well, because it was deemed on what is defined as a sensitive activity.
But in terms of that rule C, point 4.10, how does that, so it's now going to read in theory what activities, buildings and structures.
It would be...
And earthworks? Does earthworks include, I don't know, ploughing under the...
Ploughing is exempt from the definition of earthworks in the proposed district plan.
Mm-hmm.
But if that activity was captured under under a national grid sense of activity, then...
Which is in the definitions, is that right?
I don't... In terms of the definitions in the 40... in the revised chapter, there's a starting point for the notified chapter. National Grid Sensitive Activities. Mm-hmm. I recommend the revised version of the section 45 report set.
So, do any of those, are there any existing activities that are in that list?
Probably not, looking from, thinking about whether National Grid comes through Nevis and then to the Franklin substation. I'd have to have a close look, of course, any residential activity, that might be the likely one.
Is there any visitor accommodation on the vineyard through there or anything like that?
There's a good chance that there could be some. In the operative plan and the proposed plan, they have and the Gibson character zone, there's a discretionary activity status, so a good chance that Transfer might have had influence in the resource consent application.
Turning to the lines on roads, section of your summary, how are underground and overground lines addressed under the operative plan? I'm not trying to understand is there a difference in other parts of the country. I know there's a difference between if you want to somebody wants to go and put lines in underground, it's permitted, but it's controlled. If you want to go in new subdivisions, if you want to put them above ground, I'm trying to understand whether that applies here.
I need to confirm, sir, but I don't think the operative plan makes a distinction between underground and overground lines.
And in the proposed plan, do you make a distinction between underground and overground?
not in the notified version, to my understanding right now, but there are rules to do with the limitation of support structures, which is inherent that they're overground.
Mm-hmm. So it's not the intention here that the idea is for any new subdivisions or that kind of thing, that there should be a move to underground.
It's not through the rule framework. Through the policy, there is identification of that. But it's not... If it is, it could be improved, because clearly an underground line with pure discretionary activity under the notified version, and an OB line up to a certain scale would be controlled. So if there's a push to favour undergrounding over here, then it can come through.
I don't have a view on it. I was wondering if you could maybe clarify what the council's intention was in regard to that. Equally, it might not, that it hasn't really been considered.
I think there is. I'm
asking from ignorance.
I was just actually looking through the policy framework, and I do recall policy about favouring undergrounding, and I know that with new subdivision and especially any subdivision development in rural zones, we link that to.
Yeah, could you help me and take me to that policy, please?
It'll take a while.
Oh,
we have to go through it.
It's not 5 o'clock yet. About 30.2.7.2 at the top of page 36.
Here we go. Right there. Required undergrounding of services in new areas of development is technically feasible.
You pointed out that we quite use it, but it's a discretionary activity in the rules. There seems to be a bit of a gap. Should I assume that you may not have been the original author of the sketch?
That's safe to say, but
yep.
I'm
not in front of you now. So. No. You seem to get yourselves into those positions.
I think what might have... If you could imagine that the default rule said that activity is not specified with permitted instead of discretionary. The whole sort of layout and sort of approach to the chapter might would obviously be very different. And I suspect that could have been the intention through the drafting at least partway, but it's not referred to in the notified version, so you need to deal with it.
So my question then is What could we do about it, if anything?
Helen had about in the original submission for a default permitted activity status, so they started to consider that, to contemplate that. I mean, instead of providing for a range of activities, instead of specifying the activities that are contemplated, and then saying anything we haven't thought of that, or that could have an unintended effect needs the resource consent, which is the case with a lot of chapters in the proposed district plan. It could be a case of finding the activities that could have a potential adverse effect or need to be managed in some way, identifying those and then saying everything else was permitted, and therefore things like mines underground within roads would be permitted because they're not specified anywhere else and it's accepted that they, that, you know, that, that there is no adverse effects, obviously finding them if they are permitted, or it's an effect that they contemplate. That's the way around it, and there's scope to do so. To redraft my recommendations to date, retain the discretionary activity status for default. For activities not otherwise specified, but it's...
Without knowing what I'm about to ask you, in terms of how much, would you be able to consider whether you could provide that limited when you come back in the reply?
Yes, sir. Yes.
If I could take you now to the 42A report. In terms of those, Mr. Scott's already asked us about, provided us, haven't been able to find a submission or that, that would allow us to address those issues, particularly in regard to that, that energy component. There's just nothing there in terms of being able to address the matters that you've raised here about those objectives and policies, particularly in regard to trying to so now take account section 6 and 7.
Nothing specific. The submission from context is specific. The other political environment society submission does seek, in general terms, that the operative district plan is retained as it relates to things to do with landscape, but it, the upper cliff society submission is not on the energy utilities chapter specifically. So we did not think we could use that as leverage.
Mr. Sinclair is going to start on a new topic, so we will adjourn for lunch rather than run into our lunch break. And we'll return at 2:00.
Thank you.